acuestes a dormir sin comerte un cucurucho de maní.
Qué calentito y rico está, ya no se puede pedir más. Manicero se va, manicero se va. Se va, por más volverá, tal vez volverá. Sigue rebanando maní, maní, sigue rebanando.
Un saludo muy cariñoso a toda la audiencia latinoamericana, un abrazo a todos los compañeros del colectivo. María Neder, desde la quebrada de Humahuaca, Argentina.
Llegamos ya al final de un programa más de Tiempo de Mujeres en Alternativa Latinoamericana. Emitimos desde las instalaciones de radio en la Universidad de Guelph en Ontario, Canadá, CFRU 93.3 FM, y para el mundo desde www.cfru.ca y por nuestros blogs en mujeresporlademocracia.blogspot.com y alternativalatinoamericana.blogspot.com. Agradecemos, como cada sábado, la participación siempre solidaria de nuestros invitados. Se despiden de ustedes desde Colombia nuestros amigos y compañeros del colectivo Radicales Libres, Silvia Oviedo, Leandro Murillo y Luis Alberto Castaño. Desde Argentina, la querida poeta, periodista y escritora María Neder. Desde mi bello México, la amiga querida periodista maestra en estudios de género, Daniela Villegas. Desde esta cabina de radio, la queridísima Madeleine Speed, mi compañero Sergio Pochón y quien les habla, su amiga Hilda Venegas, deseándoles una noche de justicia social a nuestros pueblos. Que si el presente es de lucha, el futuro es nuestro. Buenas noches y hasta la próxima.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
Attention comrades of Canadian DIY communities and underground art scenes.
This is our house, Weird Distro, the first and only not-for-profit online store for Canadian-made cassettes, LPs, CDs, and objets d'art.
One stop, one package, one massive country.
Run by Weird Canada volunteers.
For music to hold in your hands and your hearts, check out Weird Distro at distro.weirdcanada.com.
Hey, how you doing? My radio name is Mac D, and I've been hanging around CFRU for a long, long time. Because it's fun. I started off working the equipment, producing shows, and then moved into doing my own show. Along the way, I've learned about local artists and their music, and other artists and music I never would have heard of or listened to before. I'm still here, still doing shows, still having fun. If what I do sounds like something you'd enjoy, visit us on the second floor of the University Center and find out what CFRU has to offer you.
Right now, 1 in 12 people worldwide is living with hepatitis C or B, but many people don't know their status, and the only way to know is to get tested. Do you know your status? World Hepatitis Day is an annual event that takes place worldwide on July 28th to raise awareness about the impacts of hepatitis. It is an opportunity to influence real change in prevention and access to testing and treatment. Sanguine Health Center and ARCH, HIV/AIDS Resources and Community Health, are partnering to commemorate World Hepatitis Day in Guelph on Tuesday, July 28th. Join us in St. George's Square between 12 and 3 p.m. for live music, free food and cold drinks, face painting, and fun games and prizes. Come learn about how Hep C impacts your community. Ask questions, meet our outreach team, and have some fun. Know your status? Get tested. For more information, visit Sanguine Health Center at www.sanguine.com. That's S-A-N-G-U-E-N.com. Or ARCH at www.archguelph.ca. St. George's Square is a physically accessible location at the corner of Wyndham and Quebec Street.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Yeah, this track deals with the troubles arising in Eastern Europe, which could very soon spread over to here if you're not careful. Our base instincts in check. It's cool.
The demon's rising again in this time of great crisis. No surprise that it's rising into crisis. Encouraged by betrayals of so-called socialists. Encouraged from the coffers of big business. The black shirts march again in German towns. Handing out beat downs, murdering blacks and browns. And even whites they consider inferior. Consider themselves superior. Hitler resurrected. The male disrespected. Printing a diary, giving a platform to a Nazi. These are dangerous times, so please wake up and understand what's up with the countries of Europe and in France. The NF gets votes and cuts throats in the port of Marseille. Is the fascist mainstay and nationalism feeds the fires of hate. We need to demonstrate and physically decimate this racist anti-communist crew. Kill one or two and beat the rest of them blue. Or should I say red, cause there's no quarter given or asked for, cause that's how we're living. And so I gotta ask you this then, is it just evil or to do with the system that creates nation states and racial hate, decides our fates and then devastates like the destruction it caused in World War II? Now in 92, are we going back to the day of the jackboot, or will we change forever? I don't know about you, but I go hell for leather. Beat the fascists down like they go beat a Waterloo. They're as strong as we're weak. True indeed, true indeed, true.
Well, we got troubles coming from the east side. Troubles from the east side. We got troubles coming from the east side. Yeah, trouble again.
And the world is getting nervous. Oh, mankind, you got to be conscious. Yeah.
So, okay, so you're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and one of the stories which I have been talking about on the show quite a few times, actually, over the course of the past few years, of course, is the conflict in Ukraine, you know, with the Ukrainian government besieging the Donbass region in eastern Ukraine. So today on the show, I actually have the privilege of talking to somebody who has recently been to Donetsk People's Republic in eastern Ukraine, and kind of experience what things are like right there. So I'm going to be talking to Joshua Tartakovsky, right? Is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, that's good. And it's good to have you on the show.
Good to be on your show, Chris.
Okay, so basically where I want, and maybe you could just tell people when you were actually in Donetsk.
I visited Donetsk for several days towards the end of April in a trip organized by Europa Objective. Europa Objective, mm-hmm. whose goal is to, it's a German Russian civilian initiative whose goal is to introduce journalists, bloggers, and people of interest to the region so they take them to the Donetsk and explore the area.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so for those listeners who haven't been following the situation in Ukraine, maybe you could give just an overview of the conflict and how it began.
Okay, so this whole Ukraine crisis has been going on for the past, right now we're in June, and there was the coup in Kiev was in April, but there were protests even before then. So for the past almost a year and 4 months, even not nearly, even a year and a half, but it's been going on for quite some time. I would say events began, the general impression people had of when events were beginning were in the months of early 2014, where protesters in Kiev, many of them with different civil groups with fairly decent intentions, were calling for the Ukraine to join the European Union and for President Yanukovych to step down. Now, the thing is, of course, it is fair to criticize President Yanukovych and for whatever reason. And at the same time, the demands of the protests at the time could have very well been legitimate. However, there's two points to remember about this issue. The first thing is that the U.S. was heavily involved in supporting this mobilization, but it also put at the forefront radical neo-Nazi groups mm-hmm. who were firing at the police and who hijacked the protests, and they were later placed in key government positions after the coup was successful in April 2014. In addition to that, according to several thorough investigations, for example, conducted by Professor Ivan Kachanovsky from the University of Alberta, if I'm not mistaken,
okay,
make a very clear case that snipers who fired at the protesters at Maidan in Kiev were hired by the opposition and were not. It wasn't President Yanukovych who fired at the protesters in Maidan. And what another major important thing to realize that people often do not have a good idea of is that Ukraine is a deeply divided country. It always has been and continues to be to this day. So it's not as if it's like one single entity, which we can say is Ukraine, where everyone has the same opinion and everyone would like to join the European Union. Because in the eastern part, the Russian-speaking area, who are citizens of the country, they've been living there for centuries, they see themselves more part of Russia. And they were historically more very supportive of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
In West Ukraine, and in parts of central Ukraine, they have a very strong Ukrainian nationalist movement. And they are in favor of joining the European Union. And in some parts, in Lviv, in far west Ukraine, right on the border with Poland, there was the independent state of Ukraine in 1941, whose leaders actively collaborated with the Nazis and carried out major mm-hmm. massacres of Jews and Poles, of tens of thousands, and very severe acts of cruelty which took place. And these, by the way, and these leaders are currently being glorified by the current Ukrainian government. But I think I off-tracked a bit. So let's go to a little bit further back to where I began earlier, where things were standing this year. So there was the successful... There was a coup in Kiev in which the president was toppled.
Right.
After fascist gangs such as Right Sector, which were, and other fascist groups, such as Svoboda, whose leader met with U.S. State Department representatives such as Victoria Nuland. I'm talking about Ole Tiabuk.
Right.
So in any case, there was... toppling of the government, which was unconstitutional and illegal. And after that happened, shortly after, the people in East Ukraine and the Donbass, who were also likely to economically lose significantly if Ukraine were to join the EU, because then their industries would collapse and no one would buy their products, had basically said that they do not wish to be represented by the Kiev government. They don't see it as a government that represents them, especially since it included outraged fascists, and especially since one of the first steps of the Ukrainian parliament was to outlaw the use of the Russian language
mm-hmm.
In areas where more than 10, and as well as other languages, by the way, Czech, Romanian, and so on, of different minorities. And that's, by the way, another issue which people often do not understand, is that what actually took place in Maidan, the movement eventually, was a extreme nationalist movement, because you wouldn't expect, if the goal was civil society and having true democracy, you wouldn't expect the first step to be taken after they grabbed power in April, if I'm not mistaken, in 2014, would be to outlaw languages other than Ukrainian.
Right.
So that's a very nationalist step, extremely nationalist step. And so where did things continue from there? So we have the whole story of Crimea, which I'll cover briefly. Basically, what happened was that there already are about 25,000 Russian soldiers in Crimea, which are there as part of acceptable, internationally acceptable agreements between Ukraine and Russia. And the people of Crimea have historically, for three centuries, been part of Russia. And then they were the region was given over to the Ukraine by the Soviet Prime Minister Khrushchev in the 1960s. In the mid-1960s. And in any case, there was a referendum which took place in the area, which was supervised by different representatives but was now recognized by most Western countries, although there were representatives of different Western countries there. And at the referendum, a majority supported succeeding, separating and joining Russia in Crimea. And by the way, polls after that in groups confirmed that the majority supports this move and is very pleased with it. So it's not as if it was just a fake referendum, because various polls conducted come up with the same result, that the people that was the wish of the people there. But this situation in Crimea took place as a result of the unconstitutional coup in Kiev, and in which many people were killed, which was entirely supported by the West, by the European Union, by the United States, by Canada. So basically, the coup in Kiev created a chain reaction. So the first reaction was a referendum in Crimea, and then the second reaction was that the people of Donbass, which is in East Ukraine, it's a working class mostly industrial area, they decided that they do not feel represented by the. Not only do they not feel represented, actually, but they were quite fearful of the new government, because the new government expressed very hostile views towards ethnic Russians and Russian speakers, and therefore they declared their independence. They declared the Donetsk People's Republic and the Lugansk People's Republic. And immediately after that happened, the Ukrainian government sent tanks and heavy equipment to the area, and they started firing on the residents there. And in the referendum, which took place, the majority of the people did vote for their independent republics in Donetsk and Lugansk. And soldiers who were sent by Kiev to the area actually fired at people directly who were trying to express their right to vote in this referendum. And there are videos of the events of two people from the National Guard, of the Ukrainian National Guard, firing on voters. So basically, what we have is a very interesting situation, which supposedly the question here is Ukrainian democracy. So we have a coup in Kiev, which was not democratic, which was carried out by violent actions, even though many protesters had legitimate concerns or expressing their opinion. But it was carried out by violent actions of a fascist group. And then, that is considered like legitimate and democratic. But when you have a referendum in Crimea or a referendum in Donbass where the people actually voted and did not voted in a systemic way and expressed their opinion very clearly that they do not feel represented by the new Kiev regime, then that has been that hasn't been accepted as legitimate by the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is what's going on. Just that's the overview of like the situation. So going forward from that, I just wanted to ask you, like, what is the Donetsk People's Republic? How is it organized? And you already mentioned some of this, but how did it really come about?
Okay, good question. So the referendum it was a referendum. Then there were elections.
Mm-hmm.
And then Alexander Soroshenko, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, became the prime minister. I actually got to meet the foreign minister, Alexander Kaufman. And basically, they've been having to defend themselves from the very beginning. So basically, I visited Donetsk, and I saw what is going on there. The majority of the people, almost everyone I saw, supports the Republic, but they've been in charge of basically, first of all, supplying for the citizens, because the whole area is under humanitarian blockade by Kiev. So nothing can come through from Kiev to Donetsk. And the banks have been closed down. And if I'm not mistaken, the Donetsk People's Republic recently nationalized one of the banks in the area. But the banks have been closed down, so they do not operate. And therefore, they have different currencies that are being used. So basically, they've been struggling just to defend their territory first and foremost. And that has been the main concern for now, because people are there coming under constant bombardment, even despite the ceasefire. And from what I saw, life goes on as normal to the degree possible. Like, there's a theater plays every day in the afternoon. There's a curfew in the evening. But the government is now providing pensions to the elderly and health services. The government of the Donetsk People's Republic, because the Ukrainian government cut off pensions to all people in the area, and as well as health services. So basically what we have is, because the people of Donetsk declared their own independent republic, the Kiev government has basically inflicting collective punishment on them, pretty much in reminding in many ways what Israel, different actions Israel has been carrying out against the Palestinians and imposing a collective punishment. And also in demonizing the entire population, because we have Ukrainian President Poroshenko saying like their children, like the children of people of Donbass, will be held in basements until they'll submit to us, basically. And this kind of talk of a president of a country against his own civilians, and not only civilians of his own country, but children, it also reminds me pretty much of what Israeli leaders have been saying about Gaza, that Gaza will not be peaceful, the people of Gaza will not enjoy a peaceful sleep until they stop firing rockets at Israel, for example. But in any case, the situation there is very difficult, because there's a strong case to indicate that more attacks and the area will continue, and there'll be a new onslaught. Right now, things are fairly peaceful, even though there's continued bombardment of some areas near the airport, but there's a danger that things will escalate again if the U.S. pushes for it. So I would say, as far as the People's Republic, I wouldn't say that... I would say they're basically focused mostly on... trying to maintain a normal living, return to normalcy to the degree possible. The university still function, and to provide different services, as I said, medical services, pensions, and so on. But the problem is that their status of where things are going still remains unclear, because it is not as if the people that want to join Russia, the majority say that they would agree to remain in Ukraine as long as the current regime will be replaced. The war criminals will be brought to justice, and their rights will be fully respected, their cultural rights and political rights. Well, cultural rights first and foremost. And these things are unlikely to happen. So right now they're in a war situation. They're unlikely to happen anytime soon, so they're in a war situation at the moment. And they're trying to protect what they have, and they're keen on resisting Kiev's attempt to subjugate them and take over, especially since I think they know pretty well that if the Ukrainian army succeeds to break in, which right now I don't think will happen, then this would end up in major bloodshed, because the Ukrainian army already has been committing various war crimes throughout the region, like killing civilians, bombing civilians, targeting chemical plants, hospitals. I saw a hospital that was hit, as well as residential areas, and so on. So that's the situation now.
Yeah, so the situation is very serious, like right now, you know, with this kind of stuff. And so from my understanding, like, there have been two kind of periods of conflict and two ceasefires so far, right? And so, like, we're just kind of in this kind of in-between stage where it looks like things are going to flare up again at any time.
Exactly. Because now there is officially a ceasefire, and in general, I would say there's not like a major war going on. But while I was there, we heard bombshells in our area right next to us was bombed. So the people mm-hmm. there is still like a small scale fighting taking place between the self defense forces of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Ukrainian army and other irregular Ukrainian militias which are in the area.
Mm-hmm.
But the big question is to what degree, as you said, will this ceasefire hold on? There are many forces which suggest that it won at some point if Washington pushes for it, or if there'll be an attempt. But especially my biggest concern is that as the economic situation in Ukraine deteriorates, and as the government may even be forced to default, the easiest solution for the regime would be to begin a larger war once again to evade criticism and deflect attention from the other problems and to try to forget about the economic issue.
Yeah, so try to really, really kind of play that kind of nationalist sort of rhetoric and kind of like, you know, direct the people away from their problems, this kind of thing, you know, classic reactionary tactics.
Exactly.
So I was going to ask you about the whole concept of Novorossiya and like, you know, like what is the Donetsk People's Republic relation with Luhansk and, you know, what's the framework there? You know, how does that operate? Like, how do these republics work together?
Okay, that's a good question. I'm not sure I would know that. I'll try to tell you what I know.
Okay, yeah.
First of all, I would imagine there's a lot of collaboration between the two governments, I would imagine,
mm-hmm.
and some people I talk to, that situation. Secondly, there's are many, but I would say there are some differences. Like, whereas, I would say, it seems my impression was that in Donetsk, the people that really have it more organized and more in control, while in Lugansk, a major commander, a communist commander, whose name was Mazdovoy, was just assassinated a few weeks ago, and they're still not certain who it was. So that's
right.
A major source of concern. So in Lugansk, my impression was that whereas in Donetsk, the leaders are very committed to socialist ideals, or at least to, are very, to put it bluntly, like have their act together. In Lugansk, you have many fighters who are, and the people are, but I'm not sure if everyone in the government is as clean as
right.
People in Donetsk.
Yeah, because just what I've been hearing is pretty much like the Luhansk government, there's more like kind of, I guess, Putinists, if you want to call them that, like, you know, people who kind of were more along the line of the Russian government, right? They just kind of like, you know, follow the same line that they do, and they're not as like kind of autonomous or, you know, committed to a different path, like certainly different economic principles or socialist kind of ideals or any of this sort of stuff. You know, there's kind of like this divide.
I can only say what I know. The best I know is that the Prime Minister of Lugansk, and there are people in Lugansk in various positions,
mm-hmm.
in government positions, not the public, because the public went out en masse to the funeral of Mazgovoy, who called for a major, he was a strong communist, but I don't know if they're Putinists. I would say like they do represent the people of the region. I mean, they were elected, so they're there, but they're not. I'm not sure how clean they are, like in all their affairs financially.
Okay,
bluntly.
Yeah. So there could be like questions of corruption and this
exactly,
kind of stuff.
Exactly.
So,
however, they're still obviously better off than like the the fascist groups. But
oh, yeah.
There's definitely issues about corruption.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about, I mean, I don't know how much you know about like these kind of like the forms of economic organization in Donetsk. You know, we mentioned before like a bank had been nationalized. Did you see any other examples of like nationalization or like you say like socialism being put into practice there or any of this sort of thing?
Yes, it's a good question. Well, the government provides for pensions, healthcare, and tries to keep and obviously protection and trying to keep an orderly life, like cleaning the streets, catering for the elderly, providing food for the elderly who are stuck in neighborhoods which are being constantly bombarded, and so and in such areas. I would have liked to see more outright nationalizing of different industries and so on. I haven't explored that issue in depth, and there have been some things taking place, but not at a very large scale from what I can tell.
Okay.
And my impression is that it could be possible through several reasons. Either it's because the war has been going on, and that's been the major source of concern now.
Right.
Or they've been under pressure by other forces, maybe in Moscow, maybe a local oligarch. Although, like, the local oligarch of the area fled, but
right.
but maybe by other interest groups, not to go on in this with this with this agenda.
Yeah, because I was just thinking, like, that obviously being at war is probably a major factor here. Like, and you know, if they think, like, if they do push in this direction, it's going to destabilize. You know, they're going to destabilize themselves. Like, certain people are going to, you know, turn against them. This kind of thing at a time when things are pretty desperate. I guess that could be like a part of their calculation, right?
Yes, that may be, or they may be concerned that the economy will collapse very quickly
right. If
that happens overnight. Generally, I think my impression was that they do have Roger Annis, who runs the New Cold War blog. He's a Canadian who also visited. He's been writing a bit more about the socialist plans. There are more plans for the future, but now there's. It doesn't seem like there haven't been fully being carried out. Also,
yeah.
there's a very large, a very realistic scenario with people that we're discussing, which was that if the Donbass would be attacked again in a very like significant way, then the forces of the forces of the area will be forced to will go on the offensive and liberate other villages which are currently under Ukrainian control.
Right.
But if I would dare to venture my guess, I would say that I would say two things. First of all, the majority of the fighters that I saw and I also saw fresh graves in the area are people from the region. Many people from the region are fighting. It's not as if like Russian soldiers were sent there. And
oh yeah, because that's the propaganda, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But right. at the same time, no doubt there are plenty of Russian soldiers in the area who volunteer to fight.
Right.
And also, I think there are many like strong indications that Russia has been supplying them with arms to protect themselves. So I would say there is a possibility that that these arms have been given. For example, there was a commander before Igor Sukho who had like greater ambitions to take on to take his force all the way and try to go and take over Kiev, and then he was removed, and that was, if I'm not mistaken, according to many suggestions, indicators, he was removed, and a more like pragmatic person was put in place as a precondition for the Donbass receiving military aid.
Right.
So that's the thing. My impression is that they're under pressure at this point to keep things based on the status quo. And I think, and the reason that is because, I mean, the reason that is as far as like offensive, military offensive is concerned, is because there's a big concern that if they go too much on the offensive and this could escalate much further. So Russia's been trying to prevent this from becoming a much wider war. But at the same time, it hasn't been abandoning the people of the area. So they're playing this a balancing act, but it's very possible, as you said, that there's pressure on the Donetsk People's Republic and in Austin Lugansk
yep.
by certain forces, I don't know who, but not to carry out socialist plans at this point anyway.
Okay, so maybe you could discuss like the whole, I've heard quite a few things about international volunteers coming to the Donbass, volunteering for to serve with these the various militias that are protecting the people there. So I don't know if you encountered any of these people or if you talked to them, but I mean maybe you could kind of give your impressions of these people.
I talked to a few people, and basically there's a very large, from what I understand, there's a very like large representation from Spain.
Right.
Many
yeah.
fighters came from Spain in light of a historical precedent of the 1936 civil war
mm-hmm.
in Spain, the anti-fascist war, and there are some fighters also from France, from Brazil, even apparently like some from Germany. So there are a significant number of international volunteers who came to basically fight the fascists, just as George Orwell, for example, writes in his book about Catalonia and the war in Catalonia. But I don't know what their exact numbers are. I recently saw that like about 30 Spaniards left for the Donbass like about a month and a half ago. But there's definitely like a large number of internationals, also a few Americans also who came to help.
Oh yeah,
and I would say that truly helps the people of the region to feel more empowered, because from their perspective, and rightly so, I think it's fair to argue, they've been entirely abandoned by the international community. The fact they're being bombarded, and many Western countries seem to take no issue with the fact that civilians are being killed and bombarded. So far, over 6,000 people at least have been killed. And even inside Ukraine, there's been many repressive actions taken. Many people have been kidnapped, mm-hmm. tortured. There
right.
are many testimonies of torture. So the situation is very, very bad. So the fact that international volunteers came has been very inspiring to locals.
Well, yeah, these people coming to were willing to put their lives at risk, you know, like for this cause, like the cause of these people. You know, that's very impressive.
Exactly, especially since many of them realize now that they probably won't be able to go back to their country ever, possibly.
Well, yeah, because I heard that some of the Spanish volunteers like tried to go back to Spain and they got arrested. You know, like as soon as they crossed the border, basically, and now they're like on charges of like terrorism or something.
Exactly.
Yes, I heard that. Yeah, like that's pretty disheartening to hear. But you kind of mentioned a few of these things, but I think it's definitely important to talk about the crimes of the various fascist groups, like not only like in say the Donetsk region, but like in Ukraine in general, just so we understand like what it is that these people are really up against.
Yes. Well, I was there. I saw with my own eyes the situation there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I saw elderly people living in neighborhoods. Some of them have no family, so no one there to take care of them, although they receive food and medical support by the local republic.
Yep.
And they face constant daily bombardment. I saw like grad shells inside civilian buildings inside the city. And even when we were there, we were shelled. So the Ukrainian army has intentionally been targeting residential neighborhoods and doing so with impunity. I mean, it's quite remarkable that you have Ukrainian forces who are targeting civilians, and the U.S. and the EU take no issue with that. So basically, many war crimes have been committed, like... There's been, first of all, civilians have been shot to death at gunpoint in different territories occupied by the Ukrainian forces, by the Ukrainian army.
Mm-hmm.
And citizens have also been kidnapped at checkpoints run by the Ukrainian army and then tortured severely. And then they were very severely, borrowing both techniques used by the CIA in Guantanamo, and techniques used by the Bandera fascist gangs in during World War II. And then they're usually exchanged with for Ukrainian soldiers who were captured by the Donetsk People's Republic.
Mm-hmm.
But there's probably, like, no one knows for certain, but there are hundreds of people who are currently in Ukrainian prisons being tortured. And no one knows their whereabouts. No one knows what is the latest or how they are.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, like journalists have been killed, like communist leaders have been killed. The communist party is outlawed in Ukraine.
I believe your trade unions also have been repressed, right?
Yes. Yes. Mm. Yes. And they're doing that because they embarked on a very strong austerity program.
Like privatization, like across the board, right?
Exactly. Exactly, and that's why the economic situation there is just going to deteriorate and deteriorate, because that's been also the precondition for the loans that they've been receiving for the IMF, is that they take on very strong austerity programs, and the quality of life is expected to deteriorate very rapidly, and it already is, and that's why of course, we'll be seeing like probably more and more militaristic actions taken. And also that's why the government has been engaged in like ultra-nationalist propaganda.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's very interesting. I mean, it's not just Ukraine. Ukraine is maybe the most extreme example of this. But even if you look at Poland, if you look at other countries in Eastern Europe that are really kind of, you know, engaged in mass privatization and all this sort of stuff, they use the most vitriolic nationalist rhetoric imaginable, right? And try to direct all the people's attention against various minority groups, you know, say that they're the problem. They need to be destroyed. They need to be repressed. You know, like, you know, Poland for the Poles, Ukrainian for Ukrainians, all this sort of stuff. And, you know, really it's just a cover for privatization. You know, fascism is a cover for privatization.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. Like, you make an excellent point. And I'll just make 2 points I have on this issue because I think that's an excellent, very important point. The first is that, like, I think Ukraine is a classical case to anyone who studies it, like, in depth, for the fact that fascism and capitalism goes very well together.
Yep.
And in fact, actually a Greek filmmaker just produced a film called Fascism INC in which he covers that relationship between fascism and capitalism. And he obviously claims that fascism is an advanced stage of capitalism. But that Ukraine is a perfect scenario, a very good example for a situation in which the government embarks on war and fascism because it's an economic crisis.
Yep.
And in a way, if you look at the broad picture in Europe, there's two countries where capitalism failed very clearly. The one, first one is Ukraine, the other one is Greece.
Yeah.
So while in Ukraine, the government has been pursuing war and fascism in order to have people deflect their attention from the economic crisis. In Greece, the government has been trying to negotiate it, but they're under incredible pressure and it's unclear at this point whether they will surrender or not to the dictates of the European Union, to the neoliberal dictates.
Yeah.
But these are two places where capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, failed very clearly. Obviously, Spain too, but in Greece, it's even worse.
Mm-hmm.
But very few make the connection between like the fact that this is a crisis of capitalism and that and the connection between these two regions, and also the connection between fascism and militarism and capitalism. Because if you look, the first time that actually even the word privatization, as it was in German, came from during the Nazi regime. That's when like the government carried out like privatizations.
Yeah, it's true.
And very few people are aware of that actually. So it's the thing is, it becomes very clear in the case of Ukraine and also in the case of Nazi Germany that you can have many. You can practice a very different, like, take capitalism to a very extreme stage when you have fascism on your side. And that's actually also the concern, like, globally, that we're moving more and more to a situation because capitalism seems to be in a structural crisis,
mm-hmm.
coming to its end, like, in the coming decades, as, like, Emmanuel Wallerstein, for example, argues, that basically there's we're in a situation in which we'll be moving either to feudalism and fascism. And we see it more and more in like the repression of civil liberties and the cracking and the police repression by the police in different Western countries, or to like a more socialist, a more humane alternative.
Yeah. Like, yeah, is it more like a more like even more revolutionary situation, at least in some places, you know? So
exactly.
It's like this is like the alternative basically would be is between socialism and barbarism. You know,
exactly.
It's almost becoming that. I think it was Rosa Luxemburg who said that. Originally, but yeah, like it's pretty, this is like the reason why I don't think people should ignore what's going on in Ukraine, right? Because I mean, this is like, this situation is like emerging in many, many places now, like just around the world. And you have to understand it, like if you actually want to, if you want to effectively like fight for like that better future that we've been, you know, like that socialism, right? Like you really have to understand this stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you look at the global events and understand them more thoroughly, you analyze them more thoroughly, because the mainstream media has been wholly misrepresenting entire regions, it becomes very clear. And I actually spoke to a Greek volunteer who went to visit the region, the Donbass, just a few weeks ago. And he told me, look, we're trying to basically, he came to visit, but he's been very active politically in Greece, raising awareness on the issue. And what he's saying is that we're trying to defeat like fascism and NATO in Ukraine, so that they,
yeah.
Because if they succeed in Ukraine, they'll do it in other places too, and I think we'll see more and more. That my concern is that we're going to see more and more like fascist we'll be seeing more and more fascist parties rise in different countries as the economy declines, or people choosing socialism in different countries.
Yeah, because obviously you're going to get resistance to fascism as well, right? And that's what also needs to be mentioned. You know, it's not like this kind of stuff happens without a fight. You know,
very true.
Yeah,
very true.
And I guess Donetsk is proof of that.
Very true, as well as many Ukrainians in Kiev and other places who have been protesting against protesting against the U.S. involvement. And those who spoke out against the war crimes have been arrested or killed, but many of them. But definitely people have been resisting. But I think in light of history, when we have a government which praises fascist groups and practices outright fascism, and there are many indications for that, if you look at all the characters
of fascism, mm-hmm.
then that people like today are oblivious to that is very disturbing, because fascism doesn't stop at a given point. It obviously seeks to expand.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I believe the right sector now has a presence in Toronto, actually, amongst the Ukrainian community.
Terrible.
Which is quite a disturbing thing. Golden Dawn does as well. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was, unfortunately, Joshua Tartakovsky, we were interviewing there about the situation in Ukraine. Fortunately, he got cut off, so we weren't able to quite finish the interview. But nonetheless, I do appreciate him coming on Back in the USSR. I'm going to try to have him back on at some point in the future. And we more or less, that was actually quite lucky. His phone ran out of credit just as the interview was about to end. So I think that was about the best timing we could have hoped for when it comes to something like that happening. So overall, I'm happy with it. So thank you for listening to Back in the USSR, and please stay tuned. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Killing Joke, a British band from their 1985 album Nighttime. And I think that the reason why I wanted to play that song right after I did the interview there with Joshua Tartakovsky on the situation in Ukraine, and where we talked about the atrocities, some of the atrocities committed by the fascist groups there that are very integrated with the Ukrainian army, such as Right Sector and the Azov Battalion and various other groups that are responsible for these crimes against humanity, which are running rampant, and which, of course, the U.S. and NATO and the EU do basically ignore, you know, while trying to portray the whole thing as Russian aggression. You know, Killing Joke, that particular song, A Love Like Blood, really gets into the whole mentality of fascism. You know, the whole blood and soil mentality, the whole idea that the enemies that need to be targeted and taken out are these minority populations. You know, they're viewed as unclean, as parasitic. And this, of course, is used by the capitalist class, by the ruling class, to divert people's attention from the real suffering, the real causes of their problems. You know, and this is why, during this period of austerity and economic crisis, the ruling class is increasingly turning to fascism in the same way that they did in the 1920s and 30s. You know, increasingly we're seeing this, like, not just in Ukraine, I mentioned this during the interview I did with Joshua there, but also around Europe and increasingly around the world. You know, you see governments increasingly supporting or giving at least tacit support to fascist organizations, which, of course, what the effect that they have is diverting people's attention, the public's attention, working class attention, against basically powerless minority groups. You know, and saying that, you know, Jews or Russians or whatever minority group you're talking about are the cause of people's problems and not, of course, the ruling class who is exploiting everyone. You know, and profiting from the suffering and the exploitation of working people. You know, that's the function of fascism within capitalism and within this regime of austerity that we see. So, of course, we see like groups like Right Sector and Golden Dawn and Jobbik in Hungary and, like, you know, National Front in France, which is now like one of the biggest countries in the, you know, not the biggest country, the biggest party in the country that's huge support, you know, and in other places in Sweden, in Britain, all these areas, you know, you get these far right organizations increasingly becoming mainstream. And it's a scary show. It's very scary. Now, one of the events which I was very privileged to take part in just this past Saturday was the Anti-Austerity Summit of Southern Ontario, which took place here at the University of Guelph. It was organized by a good friend of mine, Darius, and other people from Oprah Guelph. We brought a lot of people in. It was, and seeing the kind of the problems that we had, like a last-minute venue change and various other issues which did come up, we got a pretty good turnout. And seeing it also, like, conflicted with several other events which were going on that day. This, of course, was the 13th, the last Saturday. And, you know, we had this discussion, you know, in the morning. You know, this event obviously went on all day. We had a discussion about, you know, how to organize against cutbacks to social programs, exploitation of workers, and what have you around Southern Ontario. It's a very big thing right now. You know, austerity definitely is with us. It's not just places in like Europe or the third world. Austerity is definitely entrenched increasingly here. And one of the things which I brought up and some other people brought up was how various fascist organizations are starting to spring up or raise their ugly head again in Southern Ontario, like very close to home. Like I already mentioned in the talk with Joshua there that the Right Sector and Golden Dawn have a presence in Toronto. But it's not just like these, say, foreign organizations, which are now like opening chapters within Canada. No, it's like there are organizations like the Heritage Front, which has a pretty strong base in London now, and is organizing like white supremacist organization, trying to, like, you know, organize workers there and telling them that, telling working people in places like London, you know, impoverished communities, which are increasingly facing Rust Belt conditions, like industrial plants and things like that are being shut down, sent overseas, and, you know, people increasingly have no jobs, they have no work, they got to, like, accept low wage, like, service sector employment if they can get employment at all, and they're in dire straits. And then you get, like, guys like the Heritage Front coming along and telling them, you know, see, your problems are, like, dark-skinned people, you know, and immigrants, and these people are, like, coming to, like, you know, take your jobs and stuff. You know, like, this is the kind of message that they give people. And increasingly, this is what we have to organize against. We have to fight against these fascist groups. You know. And these fascist organizations have money. They're setting up offices. They got equipment. They're, you know, they have, they're running candidates in elections. They're getting votes. I mean, they're, it's obvious they're being bankrolled. You know, now maybe, of course, the organizations that are bankrolling them don't want to come forward now, probably because they're, you know, various capitalist interests within this country, pretty obviously, who are actually supporting them. Once again, diverting workers' attention, just like in Ukraine, just like in Greece, just like elsewhere in Europe and around the world, diverting people's attention away from the real cause of their problems, which, of course, is their exploitation by the ruling class. You know, the real problem is capitalism. And they want to divert people's attention from that reality as much as they can. You know, so basically they're going to support organizations, fascist organizations that brutalize powerless people. You know, on the basis of skin color, ethnicity, what have you, religion. You know, groups that target those people as opposed to targeting, you know, the capitalist class, the people who are really making profit. Making hay off of the suffering and exploitation of working people. You know, this is what we're up against. You know, and that's something that was definitely a very dominant theme in the conversation at the Anti-Austerity Summit. People are increasingly recognizing what we're up against. And that's one of the reasons why I'm very glad we were able to talk to Joshua on the show here today. Now, one of the things I'm going to play a little later on is a clip. This was actually very long. I don't know how much of this we're actually going to get through on the show today. But I'm going to play as much as I can of the panel discussion which took place during the evening session of the Anti-Austerity Summit. Because it was absolutely brilliant stuff. We had an amazing coalition. People from indigenous communities, people from anti-poverty groups, people from labor unions. All these people sitting on this panel. You know, people who were fighting for the justice of migrant workers. You know, it was a brilliant panel. And for those, and I think the only bad thing that I would say that really took place that day is there weren't enough people who actually turned up for that panel and listened to the brilliant words of these people, these brave people who have been fighting for justice in our communities. You know, in this province, in this country. These words that really need to be heard by more people. You know, I understand it was the end of the day and, you know, it was a Saturday and a lot of people were busy. Maybe they were out of town. They weren't around. There was a lot of other stuff going on. Maybe they were tired out. But I really, really wish more people had showed up to that. So here it is, another chance, right? You can listen to this, you know, you can hear what it is that these people had to say. I'll try to get to as much of it as I can. So we're going to take another music break, then we're going to kind of get into the panel discussion a little later on. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
So greedy, 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 greedy. So greedy, 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 greedy. Now they say the Celtic tiger in my hometown brings jewels and crowns, picks you up off the ground. But the Celtic tiger does two things. It brings you good luck or it eats you up for a supper. It's the tale of two cities on the Shamrock Shore. Please, sir, can I have some more? If you hear the tiger roar, run for the door. Cause if you are poor, you'll be eaten for sure. And that's how we know the poor have more taste than the rich. And that's how we know the poor have better taste than the rich.
Oh, I am your gorgeous
saint. Hear the Celtic tiger roar and one more.
And you shall.
The Celtic tiger roar, they want more.